It's time for the Plastic Scale Modeling Hour, talk radio for scale modelers. Sponsored by Grex Airbrush, the evolution in perfection. This is episode 52, published January 24th, 2013. This week, we'll take a question from our show's Facebook page, and then we'll meet Roger Jarman from Atlantic Models. We'll get things started right after this message from our sponsor, Grex Airbrush. If you're like me, you want an airbrush that is reliable, easy to clean, and more importantly, comfortable in your hand. One that is intuitive to use, which gives you greater control as you apply paint to your model. Whether you have excellent dexterity or have stiffness and limited mobility, then the Grex Tritium series is something you need to experience for yourself. Join the thousands of satisfied customers who find the pistol grip and trigger action design the answer whether doing fine, delicate work or spraying broad strokes to cover large areas. Grex offers a full line of airbrushes, spray guns, compressors, paints, and accessories. Grex Airbrush is the evolution in perfection. Find out for yourself by visiting them online at grexairbrush.com or by calling 626-289-7618 today. Let's get this episode started by answering some questions. This question comes from the show's Facebook page via Henry Jones, and Henry asked the question, do you have any tips on how to keep dust off wet paint? Well, let's just start with the basics, Henry. Make sure the area where you're painting is clean. Housekeeping. You got to dust. You got to get in there and make sure everything's wiped down. Everything's vacuumed. That includes points above the work area. Light fixtures, floor joists, rafters. You just have to make sure that everything is wiped down on a regular basis to minimize the amount of dust in the air. The other thing you might want to consider is making sure that you do have an exhaust fan, and that'll help pull the dust particles out of your workshop. Fire the exhaust system up to 15 minutes before you start actually going in there to paint. That'll pull the dust out of the workshop. Humidity is a factor. When the humidity is too low, you will find that the dust particles are attracted to plastic. Just so much static carries it to plastic. So make sure that wherever you're painting, the humidity level is somewhere between 45 and 60%. That's usually pretty ideal. That's a balanced moisture level, and it shouldn't affect your painting. Actually, in some cases, it may actually help your paint cure faster. Covers. Once you get the model painted, cover it. Use the bottom of a storage tote that's been cleaned. Okay, you don't want any dust left in there. You just dumped a bunch of sprue pieces out. You want to make sure it's wiped out and clean and cover it. You can use an old cake pan cover. You can use a shoe box. You just have to find the ideal cover that covers the model. You don't have to have a lot of space between the edges or the height. You just want to make sure it's covered and you want to make sure it's clean. You can use a pail. I mean, you can use just about anything you want to act as a cover. And you don't have to worry about any ventilation. It's not really going to make that much of a difference. Air pumps and purifiers, or I should say air purifiers and filters. I have one in my workshop, and I usually go in, and it depends on the time of year. I'll go in and turn it on 15 to 30 minutes before I actually start spraying. And it just helps pull out the dust particles, any pet dander, anything you can imagine. And like, again, the cleaner your workshop is, the more efficient these devices are. Now, a properly vented exhaust system too is very helpful, especially if you're airbrushing or using a spray can. Because when you start spraying, if there's no place for that overspray to go, it just basically hangs in the air. by having an exhaust fan, you pull that away. So that's just stuff that's not going to settle on your paint. So I hope those are some good ideas that you can use. Housekeeping, make sure you clean the workshop top to bottom, floor to ceiling. I mean, we used to paint cars, real cars, on the side for extra cash. Guys would come to us, would do some minor body work, and then they'd want their car painted. Well, we used to paint them in a barn, a dusty old barn. One of the first things we did when we got ready to paint was we take a garden hose and we literally miss the inside of the barn area where we were going to be painting. That would cause the dust to settle. And you know what? We turned out paint jobs that didn't have any dust specks in them. Okay? So it can be done. Just take some precautions and protect the model from dust, and also remove the dust as much as you can from where you're working.
Well, regardless of the scale, it can be anywhere from really, really small to absolutely huge. My next guest, Roger Jarman from Atlantic Models, can fill the niche with the model to meet your needs. Roger, welcome to the show.
I appreciate it, Jerry. I really do. And I'm glad we have this opportunity to get to talk to more people than we normally do.
Well, Roger, you and I met, it's almost been 3 years ago.
Right.
We met at Air Adventure 2010 when you were part of the crew that brought up the only flying DC-7B.
That's correct.
It doesn't seem, that just seems like yesterday.
It really does, and I feel like the older I get, the faster the clock runs, but we still have time to get involved in lots of different things, but I guess the penalty you pay is the loss of time. It seems like it just flies past so far, you know, so quickly.
You know, and part of the reason that you're in business is because time does fly by fast, and the models that your company produces helps people remember those times fondly.
That's correct, and I tell you, that's really kind of what makes it all work for us. And in fact, it was the fondness that ended up being the impetus for us buying Atlantic Models. I was a Pan American brat, and I grew up in Latin America in the 50s. And I was shuttled back and forth to Miami from Haiti and Panama and Venezuela, so I got kind of the passion for aviation. And when I came back to Miami in 1989, I really started wishing I could get a Pan Am DC-6. And as a kid, I remember Clipper Liberty Bell. And just by dumb luck, Atlantic Models was residing in Miami. So Helio built me that airplane, and I got snake bit by the place. And in 1995, we bought the company. But it was, you know, buying that airplane because it was what I grew up with, and I remembered it, and it was really personal to me. In fact, I asked Helio to autograph it for me. He wouldn't do it. He said, it's just a model. And I haven't forgotten that. He never signed it. And I've signed a couple of models for other people because I understand personally what it meant to us. And we also get to be involved with people who have us make a model that of an airplane that they met on, one, a Sabena DC-10 they were born on, and on and on. And those are the good stuff, but also one that we, the United 767s we built, a presentation that United Airlines made to the New York City Fire Department on the first anniversary of 9/11. And the idea that we get to participate in that type of event means a lot to us. And we donated those models to them for that. So there are a lot of personal pleasure in making a model airplane.
Now, let me just, I'm going to kind of go back in my modeling past, and this got me thinking, preparing for this interview, is my very first professional scale modeling job was to repair models. These, and we're talking not kits. We're talking those display models that you see on desktops, larger ones that are on display in museums and at airports, and we'll talk more about that, but my very first job was to fix the models, all these promotional models that were on display at the Military Airlift Command headquarters at Scott Air Force Base back in this is back in the 70s. And there were models get bumped and banged as they're, you know, things get moved around, and then years of back in those days, everybody seemed to smoke in the offices, and they got coated with nicotine, and they were anywhere from a light yellow haze on them to a brown grime growing on the models. But my job was, they wanted them cleaned up. They wanted those that were broken fixed, and that was my first paying gig as a scale modeler. And you and I talked yesterday prior to the interview here. You know, I said, you know, a lot of modelers in my generation aspired to become modelers in Hollywood to do all of the special effects models. Well, that's given way a lot now to computer graphics. There are still modelers, but it's not as widespread as it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But your company builds these models, these display models, and that requires scale modeling skills.
Correct. Now, a lot of people sometimes they'll pick up a model and ask what type of wood it is, and we don't use any wood in our production. We cast the desktop models in polyurethane resin, and then the much larger models are made in fiberglass. But going back to the modeling part, the initial pattern is carved in wood. And, for instance, we're one of two preferred vendors with the Boeing Company, and they'll send us model builder drawings, and we have to maintain an accuracy of plus or minus 3%. And we're really fortunate in having people here that have done this literally since they were knee-high to a grasshopper. And so what we do, I think the little thing that kind of sets us apart from other model companies, besides being so few model companies in the United States, is that we also do all of the older airplanes like DC-3s, DC-4s, and some of the seaplanes and whatnot. What we do in today's business, everybody has to make an aluminum or steel injection mold, which can be anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 investment, and we use silicone molds so that we can bring more rare and unique airplanes on that we don't have to worry about having to build 10,000 of them. So in our list of molds, we probably have over 350 different aircraft in different scales. Some of them we may only do one a year, and others 10 a year. The 737-700 is probably the current quantity leader in that we do about 700 a year. But by and large, by going with the rubber molds that are less expensive, less of an investment, it gives us the ability to provide a wider breadth of product lines.
Let's talk a minute about size. Now, we said desktop models. What's probably the smallest airplane that you produce as a desktop model?
Well, it's a two-part answer. I say a 1 to 100 is probably a standard small, if you will. But when you get into the wide-body aircraft, we do a lot of those in 1 to 144th. And then even fewer that we do in 1 to 200 scale. And those might be the 777 or the 747. And we essentially got away from doing a regular line of 1 to 200 scale aircraft simply because I didn't have the confidence that a customer would be willing to pay what it costs us to make a 1 to 200 as opposed to a 1 to 100. The reality of it is much of the labor is the same, and what you're looking at in polyurethane is, you know, $10 or $15 difference. And the customer perception typically is large airplane, large price, small airplane, small price, and it just doesn't work out that way. So on occasion, when somebody says, well, I do a 1 to 200, I say, if it's worth it to you, and it is worth it to collectors that they want to maintain their collection in all the same scale. So we ended up doing actually more 1 to 200s and 1 to 144s than I thought possible, but that's driven by their desire to have the collection being in one scale.
Now take that to the other spectrum. What's the largest model you have built?
Okay, in scale, the largest single model, you know, a complete airplane, is a 1 to 3 Embraer 195. And it's actually, we're building 10 of them for Azul down in Brazil. And that airplane is at 1 to 3, has a 42-foot length and a 31-foot wingspan. And those are going to be installed in public parks as sculptures for advertising. And then we've also done 1 to 1 scale, where we did a 727 nose section for the lobby of a large shipping company. And what we did was we actually went over to Miami Airport and cut the nose off of a 727, brought it here, peeled the paint off, and made a mold, then made a copy. The reason we didn't use the actual airplane was the wall wasn't structurally strong enough to handle the real airplane. So they needed something lighter but full-sized. And what was such a pleasure with that is that you could go in and, of course, when you make a mold, you could see the rivet heads and the screws, the zerks and everything. And people would stand there and just swear it was for real, and it was always a lot of fun. But within that, in the last couple of years, we've had requests to now to do, in addition to, you know, a full-size piece of an airplane, we have a quote out that looks like it's going to come to fruition to build a full-size F4U Corsair, and also in one of the UAVs, which is about a 68-foot wingspan and about 40 feet long for another government agency. So, you know, it's literally we can build them any size you need. And with regards to scales, you know, we talk about scales, 1 to 3, 1 to 100, 1 to 144th. But in one instance, in this case, it was a DHL. It developed a new lobby up in Fort Lauderdale at their headquarters. And they couldn't decide on the scale, so we went and we were standing there in the lobby, and the manager outstretched his arms and he said, "I want it this big." And I said, "Well, hold that pose," and measured it, and might have been 58 inches or something, and I said, okay, so we made the model to that scale, or to that size. So we literally do custom-make one-offs that way. And of course, a one-off is going to be a lot more expensive than something that we've got molds for that we make copies from. But nevertheless, it's available.
You're not building these in your basement, are you?
No. We've really been fortunate as well as that. When we moved into this facility, Helio had four 1,000-square-foot bays, and today we've expanded it to 13 bays. And, of course, everybody asks, well, why don't you just buy your own? And we don't want to do that, number one, because we have that flexibility to expand as needed. And I tell my wife that we can contract as needed, although we've never contracted. We've only expanded. So she's waiting for that contraction because the women, you know, they're always looking at the money side of things. And tell her, no, don't worry. We'll grow into it, and we seem to keep growing into more and more space. So we're located right off the northwest, about 2 miles from the property at Miami Airport. And people come in here, and we show them all of our little nooks and crannies and warehouses where there's molds and patterns and airplanes hanging half done and airplanes in the paint and in the art department where the design takes place to develop the artwork for it. So we get to show them a lot of stuff, and they sometimes are surprised how many square feet we have here and all the stuff in there, because we don't go into an empty space. We take it and fill it and continue working.
Now, if people want to see the models that you were talking about, they can visit your website, and that's atlantic-models.com. And we'll have a link on the show page for this.
Okay.
But, you know, people will, more and more of your customers, more and more of your models are now on display at military installations.
That's a funny story. Helio, when I took over, he made the, you know, I hearken it back to my father giving me advice as a young man. And more often than not, I had to go out and prove the dad that he was correct, you know, and so instead of avoiding a mistake, I had to go out there and make the mistake and have to admit that dad was correct. But in this case, Helio, he had never gotten into the large models, and when he left, he said, if you ever take a piece of advice, don't ever get involved in large models. Well, again, I never took much advice. I wanted to prove it. But within a year, we had gotten a request from Emory Air Freight. They had a new facility up in Cincinnati and wanted us to build a large DC-10 model for the lobby and in a short period of time. And what they offered us to do it, I thought, gee whiz, we can make money doing that. And it was a successful job. And the more I looked around, the less I saw people involved in it. And like our desktops, it were a niche market with a lot of unique airframes, custom painted. I quickly found out that these large models were also a niche market. And our next one was a quote to the Boeing company to do 5 models at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at the support project's office facility. And it was kind of funny because the biggest one that we were quoting was a 12-foot B-1 bomber. And I got a call from Boeing, and they said, we need that B-1 to go up to 22 feet. And it really kind of half scared me because, to me, that's like a 22-foot ski boat on a stick. So we would have to really think through how we would build it and make sure that it worked well. So I tried to argue out of it, and they insisted on it. And I said, why? And they said, well, because Northrop built them an 18-foot B-2 bomber, and Boeing's had to be bigger than Northrop's. So size mattered. And so we did build it, and the airplane's given a real good service. And then as people would visit the support projects office at Wright Path from all the different bases, they'd ask them where they got it from. So we got a call from, you know, Elmendorf in Alaska or out to Hawaii for C-17s, Westover up in Massachusetts, and up at Barksdale, we replaced an Atlas 10B rocket on a pad with a 23-foot B-52. And I never thought I'd ever do another one, but we currently have on order 3 more 23-foot B-52s. So that it kind of feeds on itself. And it's been a business that we feel really, really proud of because our military, as far as I'm concerned, they walk on water, and we absolutely love going to the bases to do the installations and be able to give thanks to them of what they do for our country and keep us safe. And we work very, very hard to make sure that they're proud of us as well.
And it kind of goes hand in hand. A lot of the gate guard models that are aircraft that were on display, they're not being utilized as they once were. I mean, most of the stuff that is flying today that gets retired, it ends up not so much on static display. It ends up going to, you know, out to Tucson to maintain a model. I know just here recently watching a program on one of the television shows, I think it was American Restorations, a new series it's on, and he actually got to restore a display model that was created by one of the airlines of the F-105 in Thunderbird markings, and he had to restore that back to the way it was.
Wow.
You know, and that, he's, you know, and we're talking a model that was, well, when did the F-105 fly? Well, look at how long ago that was, and it only flew for one season. The Republic had given the Thunderbirds a display model that was large, like you're talking about, putting in front of different buildings at different bases, and to go through and restore that. And that was a lot of work, but it came out looking nice. It's a cost-saving measure. I think models can sometimes be more appropriate because if you have a limited space where before you'd put one airplane on display, now you can size that down a little bit and put several aircraft on display in a model form, and you fill that niche.
Well, and we have a good example of that. I agree with you. At MacDill Air Force Base, they have a KB-50, an F-4 Phantom, and an F-16 on display. And those three aircraft cost them $20,000 per airplane per year for corrosion control and repainting. And they do corrosion control and repaint every 3 years. And it's just those three airplanes. And there have been about 15 different aircraft based at MacDill since World War II. So, of course, the retirees that come there want to know where their airplane is. And they had an opportunity to be able to display all of them via 1 to 20 scale models in a new medical center that they built over there. So we got to build from the Boeing, the Bolo bomber, P-51, A-26, and KC-135, F-102, the T-Bird, KB-50, KC-97, B-47, and all of those are arranged on a wall in a very large waiting room at the medical center. And now everybody's satisfied. And as I understand it, the Air Force is probably going to retrieve that KB-50 and run it back to either out to Arizona or up to Wright Pat. Because while those airplanes are on display at air bases, they still belong to the Air Force and subject to Wright Pat's, you know, determination on where they're going to be. So we actually see a future in building these 1 to 20 scale models to put on display either interior or exterior in a model park for air bases all over the world. That's something we've been working on, and it's continuing because it's a cost savings.
You know, there are themed restaurants around the world that are aviation themed. I've been to Squadron in St. Louis many, many years ago. They had scale models out in front of their restaurant, World War One fighters. Some places use World War II stuff, but, you know, here you provide a means for those businesses, whether it be a restaurant, whether it be a retail store, whether it be a corporate office, to have a model. Tension getting as soon as you see it in model, as they walk in, as they walk up to the facility, no matter what the subject is, you provide that, or you have the ability to provide that.
We really do love the heck out of that. You know, one of the B-52s that I mentioned earlier is going to be installed in at Barksdale Air Force Base and their new command headquarters. And but on the commercial side of things, I was just out in Dallas and helping Southwest come together with building a 24-foot 737-800 for a new training lobby that they're installing. The airplane will be installed at the end of the year. But, you know, those are specific aircraft for specific airlines or Air Force. But we also have done models for corporations where, you know, we've done BAE Systems. Well, everyone knows they don't operate 767s, but at a trade show, they needed a 767-200, and we painted it up in BAE colors. So, you know, you get to do that not only just for the people who actually fly the airplane, but any corporation that might want to put their name or, you know, we design a livery for them. We've done that for freight forwarders in the cargo business where they move a lot of freight, but they're using Atlas Air or different airlines. But they want to be able to show their customers that this is the type of airplane they fly, so they put their logo on that type of aircraft that they're moving the customer's freight on.
You know, and I'm going to talk a couple other things about some of the products you offer. Now, you offer, and I think this is really cool, you're offering aircraft noses in 1/10 scale. Right now you have some of the Boeing family. You have a C-130 that can be hung on a wall, done in the livery or the markings, whatever you want your nose to be displayed. These can also be put on plaques, be presented as trophies or gifts, and it's something that's unique. You also are, looking at your website, you also have replica propellers.
Correct. Now,
you know,
those noses, the military was again the reason I started it. After 9/11, they came up with the nose art, Let's Roll, with the sword and the American Eagle, and I absolutely loved that art. And I saw it on a KC-135 one day, and you know, that coupled with people seeing the full-sized 727 nose we did, their comment was, gee whiz, I wish I had enough room for that. So when I saw the Let's Roll artwork, I decided I'm going to do a KC-135 that could be mounted on a wall. in a 1 to 10 scale, which I did, and we started selling those. And at the same time, we had a requirement to do a C-130 nose, so we did that. And in time, we started adding more and more. But it back at the beginning, we had been asked to donate 3 models for an auction that Herb Kelleher was going to sign the models. And so I thought I'd surprise him and make a Southwest Spirit nose to gift to him at the same event. Well, these models at the silent auction sold for $4,500 a piece. And I thought, holy cow, if those models would go for that, I wonder what the heck the nose could go for. So I presented the nose to Herb Kelleher, and I said, look, I'm not an Indian giver, but the models really got a lot of money, and if you would be so kind to auction this off, I'll replace it. So he's just a wonderful person. He said, sure, happy to do that. Well, he proceeded to auction it off at this dinner, and we raised $17,500 for it, and that goes to aviation scholarships. So we kind of slipped into that side of things, and since then, we've done noses like for the Beach Jet for Barrington Irving and for the DC-7, the Eastern DC-7 that John Travolta has signed and Sully Sullenberger has signed. We've added the 767 and Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, signed recently, and we raised $2,900 for that. So all in all, for charity, we've raised over $150,000 on noses that, you know, something that would retail for $450 is getting thousands upon thousands of dollars at charities. So we've kind of ended up doing a famous signature, you know, group. And it thrills me to death to think that for our somewhat little effort can raise and have an impact on the community that way is just something that we love doing.
Now, we've been talking about airplanes, but that is not strictly what you build. You do some other things for clients as well.
Well, similar airplane is, of course, helicopters. And while we don't do desktop helicopters, we've done a 10-foot Black Hawk for the Mexican Federal Police. We're also doing a 6-footer for them. And then we're doing an 8-foot Pave Hawk, which is like a Black Hawk with different equipment on it. And that'll be installed at an air base up on Long Island. And then beyond that, we've done ships for Lockheed, you know, some of the new stealthy cruisers. And we've also done Hummers for AM General. And we more recently did in a larger scale was it was about a 90% scale of a Formula One racer. And we built that for a company down in Cancun, Mexico, and it has a live cockpit and pedals for a video game, and they'll add the wraparound screen to it once it gets there. But the car, from the tires, wheels, body, and everything, is completely fiberglass, and you can stand right next to it and just swear that it's fiberglass and metal, particularly the tires and wheels, but it's all fiberglass. And that's kind of opening up another door for us, for people who sponsor race cars, to have us build a car like that and put it in their visitor chalets at races to get pictures of their customers in a race car, which is actually just a model from us. So we'll see where that goes. But we're game to bring it on.
Well, I'm also looking at a railroad car. So you're really...
I forgot about that one.
You're really diversified there.
Yeah, that railroad car was just... It was a new design and different size, and that was just one lot of 25 cars that we built for the manufacturer. Probably never see it in the railroad store, you know, an HO scale or anything. That happened to be an HO scale. We also, we toy a little bit with joystick controls from Airbus, but that was an area that there's actually more labor in it than we felt we could justify charging. So, but although we do a little bit of that, we don't do a whole lot.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what we talked about yesterday, and we were preparing for the interview. Fundamentals. We've talked about that here on the show, that as a scale modeler, you have to master the fundamentals and complete it the first step before going on to the next step, because if you don't have it mastered at the first step, every step thereafter is going to cause you problems. And the same thing holds true with the models that you're building and your model makers build. They have to stick with the fundamentals.
Right. Well, when we give tours here all the time, and we love showing people what we do, and our employees, you know, take a lot of pride when they find out that this person is from Japan or from Europe or from Latin America, that they've traveled to come to see what they do here for a living. And the most common question is, what is the most important step in the process? And from start to finish, it takes about 2 weeks to process an airplane. Not that we're working on it for 2 weeks, but the resin has to have an opportunity to cure and degas, as does the paint and the decal sheet and the clear coat. And if you try to rush it, it's just asking for trouble. But when you say, you know, each step is important, we were doing a special 757 model for a customer, and it had static discharge wicks on the wingtips and had landing gear and lights, and we got all the way through the process when the fuselage started weeping just like a little dot. And what that meant was that the resin was not properly stirred. There was a little bit of resin that was not cured, and it never would cure. And, you know, we've tried repairing those things, like drilling a hole like a cavity in a tooth and patching it, but it never works. So we still have that airplane around here to show people that, you know, every step is important, beginning with that very first one. But you're absolutely right. It's the same as on all modelers.
The models that you produce, and I've seen some of them up close, they're fantastic. While we're on the subject, and I just have to remember, one of our previous guests and friends, mutual friends, he spent some of his time down there working with you to help produce decals. And that'd be our friend from Draw Decal, Greg Drawbaugh.
Yep. In fact, he's here today, but we love having them here. You know, any modeler or designer like Greg is a source of information for us, and a lot of our information, you know, unless it's more current aircraft, we have to do our due diligence and Googling everything we can find on it to get the correct information. So it never fails that we end up being able to provide Greg with some information, And he in turn provides us with some information that we were lacking. But even modelers that visit with us, we get to exchange processes and, you know, shortcuts of what they might do to get something done. We currently are working on some models for RC modeling. We've been requested to do a 1 to 30 scale MD-11. And the modeler that came in was talking about a P-51 that he did and how many thousands of rivets that he installed in that model. And I told him, in our case, what we do is we have a process whereby we essentially print 3D rivets in a decal form. And, you know, he was kind of blown away, because obviously it would save him a million hours of putting in these rivets individually. And so here we benefited immediately by being able to, you know, let him know what we do, and then he was showing us some processes that he uses when he's making molds and patterns that we also benefited by. So we never miss an opportunity to try to learn from a visitor, and we're very generous as we can be to share what we know with visitors. So anybody that wants to come down and say they had an issue with something and how do we handle it, we love sharing that with them.
Roger, how is technology changing how you build models?
That's a very good question. When we started in 1995, all of our decals were silkscreened, the old-fashioned way. And as years went by, it became harder and harder to get the quality that you wanted, and also the expense of doing minimum runs and the inability to do specials. So the first specials that we started doing were with the little Alps printer. That those things were great little printers. They cost just a couple $100. But in a few years, they were obsolete. They weren't being supported, and Kodak came out with a for the lack of a better description, a diesel-powered ALPS machine called the First Check, and that was about $4,000, and we quickly went with that so we could do one of a kind. But the majority of our business were with our silkscreen. Unfortunately, First Check didn't last but less than 2 years, and so we were in the market, and I came across a machine that was an enormous investment, $125,000, but it printed white and allowed us to do all of our artwork. And so that was about 6 years ago. So as of today, I would say that 95% of the decals that we apply on an airplane come off that machine now. So if anybody needs some 10,000 decals I have in storage from the old stuff, they're more than welcome to them, and we do sell those or print the new digital decals. But so that technology in printing was enormous to allow us to do the one-offs. The other thing that changed 10 years ago when we did the 23-foot B-52, we went down to the copy place and had them generate flat drawings of the three view of a 23-foot B-52. And you can only imagine trying to figure out how to carve that airplane accurately with drawings that big. And then we have graduated since then where we use a three-dimensional CAD file and have it that same model cut on a CNC router. And that puts us ahead of the game, much more accurate than we could do before. And there's two ways of looking at it. When we did it with flat paper, we could only do about four of those models a year. Today, with being able to take that shortcut and have the model cut in styrofoam before we start, we can now do 15 or 20 of those in a year. And what that's also done is reduce the cost. So the market, where it'd be few people could afford a $70,000 model, it is now a market that same $70,000 model that went out there 10 years ago can now be a $40,000 model today. Even though, fiberglass and labor and everything else has gone up, we can still produce that. And $40,000 is a lot of money to most people, but taken into account, this is for an exterior display where this model can handle 100-mile-an-hour winds and the local snow load requirements of the building. So we have a C-17 out there that has a 5,300-pound snow load capacity up in Alaska. So those are requirements that we have to build in, and that makes it expensive. But by the same token, there are more $40,000 customers than there are $70,000 customers, as we all know.
Yeah, modelers tend to complain about a $100 kit and 1/48 scale. I think putting it in perspective, the numbers that you just mentioned, this, and again, it's for different purposes. It's a lot different purpose.
Right.
So, as you said, they're engineered. They have to endure the elements. I can just imagine, the C-17 model up in Alaska, not only does it have to withstand the weight of the wet snow, but it also has to extend to survive temperature extremes.
Right.
Like a real aircraft has to.
Right. Well, and that's kind of funny. On the military airplanes, they all want to know how long the paint job is good for. And I tell them it's the same as your own airplanes. And their head drops and said, well, that's 3 years. Before you start noticing. We say that because we use the same paint that they use on the airplane. And we have a wonderful relationship with a paint supplier, or they call it coatings, we call it paint, but the coating supplier provides a lot of the paint to the Air Force. There are several suppliers. But we try to use actual aircraft paint on our models as well, wherever we can. And if we don't have that paint, that particular color, then we use a high-end automotive paint. And so the high-end automotive paint with our UV cure decals, gives you an airplane that will last for a lot of years. The art won't fade on you.
More of the program right after these messages.
That's the theme that introduces the Big Band Jump program.
If big band music makes your scale modeling time more enjoyable, join me, Don Kennedy, for Big Band Jump.
After listening to this week's episode of the Plastic Scale Modeling Hour Talk Radio for Scale Modelers, click on the BBJ icon to join me for the latest edition of Big Band Jump. We welcome your attendance.
For over 65 years, Revell Incorporated and its associate companies have offered a wide variety of model kits for every taste and age group in the hobby market. A consistent level of detail and accuracy assures every modeler that the kit they buy will be the most accurate representation possible of their favorite subject and confirms that Revell kits are the best value for the money. Revell remains committed to the foundation of the brand, interaction with products, authenticity of experience, and above all, fun. We're proud to have Revell as a supporter of the Plastic Scale Modeling Hour. Visit Revell.com to learn more about the company and its vast product offerings. Check out Revell USA on Facebook and be sure to like and tell them that you're a fan of the show.
VideoWorkbench.com is the place to learn to build and paint model kits like an expert. Hosted by award-winning hobbyist and owner of Video Workbench, Jason Garris, his videos show how to achieve top quality, contest-winning results and demonstrates how anyone can make great-looking scale model kits no matter the age or skill level. Join VideoWorkbench.com and Jason Garris on Facebook, YouTube, Blip.tv, and iTunes to learn the latest tips, tools, and techniques.
That's right, Chippy. Zuron tools are the perfect choice for our hobby and craft projects. They are made here in the USA. They are quality tools that offer the highest precision as well as comfort and durability. Let's not forget about their excellent warranty. Yes, Chippy, you have your own special needs, which Zuron Tool provides the best and most affordable solution for. And we know you demand only the very best. Zuron Tools are available from most hobby and craft stores. Visit Zuron.com today. Zuron is spelled X-U-R-O-N. We want to thank Zuron Tools for being a supporter of the Plastic Scale Modeling Hour. Now more of my interview with this week's guest.
One of the things that comes up occasionally is people will call us and say, hey, I've got this old model, and I've had it in a box ever since I've had it. I've taken good care of it, and it's yellow. Is there a lack of sunlight that causes that yellowing? Now, the clear coat itself, there's only one source for water slide decals, and that's made by NADSTAR. And when you pour that from the gallon can into a jar, it's actually amber in color. And so when you apply that as a top coat to a decal, you've got to be really careful that if you don't put enough, the decal can break up on you when you put it in the water. And if you put too much, it literally will be yellow right off the bat, so you can't really use that decal. And so you just have to have just the right amount on it. So decals that break up, not enough clear. Decals that are yellow, too much clear. Decals that are yellow, they've been sitting in the dark for too long. So, again, that's something that I think all modelers would like to know. I know that some modelers use, you know, a furniture floor wax or something to do it, but we use it, you know, when we finish installing our decal, we put an automotive clear coat on it, and that won't yellow. It's strictly the clear coat that's available for water slide decals. And it's not because, you know, I made the comment, we can send a man to the moon, but we can't make a clear. And they said, well, the problem is that the clear coat for water slide decals is actually a resin that gives it the flexibility and stretchability that you can use to put it on, whereas if we just sprayed a clear coat on it, it would be too stiff and brittle to be able to handle.
Well, that's good information.
Yeah.
There's a lot of buzz right now amongst scale modeling, the future, talking about 3D printing. Do you see that as something that you're going to look into?
Well, you know, I never say never. When Southwest came to us, they asked if I did 1 to 60 scale, and I said, I never say never, it depends on the order. And they said, well, how about 250 of them? And so I knew there was a good reason not to say never. With 3D printing, I think that from our standpoint, you know, we've been able to satisfy our requirements without it, but I see it in our future, particularly with prototyping. In the meantime, when we need it, we'll have a 3D printer print stuff for us, you know, an outside contractor. There's a lot of sources for that. You know, companies like Motorola, for instance, has a local facility, and they offer that printing to the general public. And so in a number of years, those machines will be in a price range that would make sense for us to do. And of course, someday, maybe modelers won't be needed. You just print it, and I want a Pan Am DC6, and the printer will do the whole thing for you, finished. But in the meantime, it isn't quite there for us, but I'm really fascinated by the 3D printing and 3D color printing and everything else it can do.
Well, that's interesting to hear. I mean, I if we could push a button, it'd be done for you. Where there's just no thrill in pushing the button for a lot of people. They like the whole aspect of the research, the building, the scratch building. That's, you know, modeling to a lot of us. But listening to you talk today, if you're a modeler and you have aspirations to build, and if you like scratch building, there's a future for you, because what you're telling us is you're being successful. You've got modelers there, and essentially you create the master pattern, which there's modelers that's what they like doing. A lot of the aftermarket manufacturers, these guys have to create the masters so they can do their resin casting. And in essence, that's what you're doing, but on a much grander scale as far as not only size, but in volume.
Right, right. Well, you know, we have a niche market. We recognize that. And we have 16 fellow airplane nuts here. And with that, we typically carry a 2-month or more backlog. And people have asked us, why in the world wouldn't we get much larger, which there are other companies that are much larger. The nature of our business is we are airplane nuts. And I said, if I had 50 employees here, which the business could carry, I said, you wouldn't be able to sit and talk with me. You'd have to talk to my secretary. So there's two parts of this business. One, you know, we didn't get into this for the money. We got into this because we figured we could have a lot of fun and at the same time make a living. And so, you know, we feel that we're part and parcel of the model builders. And, you know, we've donated models to IPMS functions. Not that we could afford to put them everywhere, but, you know, there are some modelers that would enjoy getting a model already built, and they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to try to figure out how to do the artwork or the model or anything else. But any of those issues that are with a single individual modeler is us. We are the same here, except multiplied by 16. But each individual is a modeler here that enjoys what they're doing and not a part of a production line. And for last, when we talk about some criticism, we're importing stuff from China. I think those people have a role, and that market is much larger than what we serve. But just so everybody knows, we had the opportunity to make 6 models, 6 one-offs that we sent for an air museum in China, because they're not accustomed to making one of everything. So it is a two-way street to a certain extent. And so our markets aren't just in Europe and in Asia, but also in China, where everybody says it's all coming from. So modelers have a role even in China for one-offs.
And for a scale modeler who likes to build his own, and there's a lot of times when the subject that they want to build, there's not a kit available, they're not so inclined to build from scratch or from plans, you offer some subjects that they may be looking for that they could purchase and then finish themselves.
Correct. Yeah, any of the models that we make, we're more than happy to sell the blanks. and as well as the artwork. So we've had people that, you know, would, they may have a decal that, but they just need the blank, and vice versa. They have a blank, let's say the Heller DC-6 kit, I think is a popular model, but we do a lot of artwork that will fit the Heller kit. And so they'll buy those to finish their own models. So whatever works.
And that's the modeler's, that's tend to be a modeler's, you know, creed. Just do whatever works. You know, get it done.
Right.
Again, Atlantic Models, you can visit the website at atlantic-models.com. We'll include a link on the show post so you can click right in and look at their website and look at the pictures and all the different products that they do offer. And Roger, I'm hoping to someday see you again either there, you know, on a nice cold winter day. Miami sounds pretty attractive, or possibly back up at Oshkosh again.
Well, let's hope it's both.
That's a good thing to hope for. Yes.
All right. Well, Jerry, I really appreciate you giving us the chance to chat with you, and again, it's just an invitation to everybody. Come on down. Coffee's on. And love to show you what we do.
If you want to share a comment with us, you can do so either by leaving a voicemail via Skype. Our Skype address is the Plastic Scale Modeling Hour. Or you can use either your computer or smartphone to record a message and email it to us. Who knows? Maybe we'll include it on the show. If you want to be a guest or suggest a guest, if you want to promote your scale modeling event, organization, or to learn how you can support or sponsor the program, contact us by email. Our address is mailbag@theplasticscalemodelinghour.com. Fellow scale model enthusiasts, remember, it's not the workbench that makes the model. It is the modeler at the workbench. This is Hawkeye. I hope you can tune in each and every week. Until then, happy modeling. The Plastic Scale Modeling Hour, talk radio for scale modelers, is produced, copyrighted, and syndicated by 0-60 Marketing, LLC, Neenah, Wisconsin. Accelerate your business with 0-60 Marketing. The reproduction or rebroadcasting of this program is prohibited without the written consent of 0-60 Marketing. Until next time, see ya!